Welcome back to Everyday Holiness, a Faith Indie podcast brought to you by the Notre Dame Alumni Association. This is again your host, Dan Allen, Associate Director of Spirituality and Service, and I'm glad to have you all with us for this episode of the podcast. I'm pleased to welcome Patrick Gary. Patrick is the son of a Notre Dame graduate. His father, Michael, graduated from Notre Dame in 1945, and so Patrick's the son of Michael and Elizabeth Gary. We're going to be talking about their lives as well as Patrick's, especially through the lens of one of Patrick's books, The Power of Gratitude, Charting a Path Towards a Joyous and Faith-Filled Life. So we'll get into all that. Patrick is also a professor at the University of South Dakota in the law school, and as I said, is an author of a number of publications and books. But Patrick, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks a lot, Dan. It's sure good to spend this time with you.
Yes, I agree. Glad to be with you. So we normally start with the guest's childhood and beginning, but I think because we're talking about your parents, let's start first with their beginnings. Where were your parents originally from? What were some important aspects of their early years?
Sure. Well, I talk about this in the book because they grew up during the Great Depression, so they certainly had a lot of material challenges in their life. My mother grew up in Minneapolis, and so she had a city, an urban existence.
Okay. I
think their families were even more hit by the Great Depression there. She would spend her summers up at her aunt's and uncle's house in North Dakota in a small town. And that kind of became, she had very fond memories of that, being able to go up there. From her father struggled from, he came from Akron, Ohio, where he had to leave because there, that was a highly industrial town. They were laying off people. He struggled to find a job. And so she lived in that environment in a small town in North Dakota for her summers. My father grew up in the very small town of Iona, Minnesota, where his father owned a grain elevator. It's a tiny town of just a few hundred people.
Okay.
So they certainly grew up in an age of material deprivation, but as their lives turned out, that material deprivation sure didn't seem to have any kind of lasting impact on them.
Well, that's good to hear. Yeah, sometimes it's hard to believe. You hear some of those stories of those times and the perseverance that people had there. As your dad progressed through life, did he stay mostly in the same place? What brought him to Notre Dame? What were some of those moments like?
Well, so he grew up in this small town of Iona. His father bought a grain elevator there. And the reason they went to Iona, his father and mother wanted to be in a town that had a Catholic church and a Catholic school.
I see.
Iona only had one school, and it was Catholic. So it's a very Catholic town, but it was German Catholic. And my grandparents were both 100% Irish. So they had the experience of, they were similar in religion, but different in ethnic backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother, as my father always said, really had a knack for getting along with different kinds of people. And so they stayed there until their oldest daughter got married, and they turned the elevator over to her and her husband. Then they moved to Fairmont, Minnesota. That's where my father went to high school. And from high school, he went to Notre Dame. And he came to Notre Dame because of the advice of a priest. He never saw it ahead of time. I mean, it's not like he took college trips there.
Right.
He just got on a train by himself and ended up in South Bend at the University of Notre Dame. And he worked for most of the time. When I heard stories about him going to college, it was more like he had a job than he was a student. Always having a job, always working. I have some of his old notebooks and inscribed books from some of his professors. So he must have done well enough as a student, despite all the jobs.
Sure, sure. Yeah, maybe tuition was at the point where you could work your way back through college back then.
You know, that's true, Dan. I mean, it was, I think when you contrast it today, you could work and you could make it. And so you did work.
Yeah.
I think nowadays, oftentimes students face the task of the bill is so monumental, kind of what's the point of working? Because you just can't make a dent in it.
Yeah, certainly a challenge there. And obviously try and help people graduate from Notre Dame without too many student loans, but certainly different than it was in, and your father was here during really the years of World War II, it seems like. What were some of his stories of Notre Dame during that time that were really marked by these monumental world events?
Well, so you're right, Dan. He was there during the war. When he went to school, the war wasn't quite on yet. He was in the School of Architecture, worked very hard. He had a natural drawing ability, but given the fact that he grew up in a small town, he didn't really have the training, and so he worked really hard. I think probably he worked so hard that he exhausted himself, and he came down with rheumatic fever. And that was at the end of his first year in college. So rheumatic fever at that time was very serious with a high mortality rate. He went home and the doctor prescribed 6 months in bed.
Wow.
My father was of the type that his friends, once they knew he was in Fairmont, they kept visiting to the chagrin of his mother. But he did come back. So he recovered. He came back. And by this time, of course, the war was on. But because rheumatic fever left him with a damaged heart, he was not eligible for the military.
I see.
It's interesting, Dan, when we would go to, he always took us to his Notre Dame reunions. In fact, at a certain point in his life, he went every single year,
yeah,
you know, to that summer reunion.
Sure,
weekend.
Sure, yeah.
So I or my brothers would drive him there. And so we got to know all of his friends. It's interesting when you look at all of the people in his class, they all shared something that what they shared is they couldn't go into the military.
Mm-hmm.
So there was someone with a limp and someone with this or someone with that. They went to college in a very unusual time.
Right.
When, you know, what they did primarily, according to my dad, was they went to school and then they got jobs in the cafeteria waiting on all of the Navy officers who, during the war, Notre Dame opened itself up to naval officers.
Right.
And it was a center for naval training. Mm. And that's how they spent the war.
Wow. Yeah, a really fascinating experience. Obviously, a lot of times the movies and the books and such highlight on the activities of the war, but kind of behind the scenes and how life went on, both at Notre Dame and elsewhere. Also very interesting to hear. Now, when he graduated from Notre Dame, what were some decisions that he had to make in terms of going back to Minnesota or taking up a career elsewhere? What was that like for him?
Well, he had a lot of offers. I look back at that as I was writing this book. I kept trying to put myself in his position and at times at my mother's position. She was in a different situation, but
yeah,
here it is. My father had graduated. So I said he was working all the time. He tells one story. He's working at a factory that's no longer open, but it was downtown South Bend. And he was working with a guy who apparently his girlfriend asked my father to a dance. My father didn't know that, in fact, the guy he was working with was her boyfriend, and he dropped an anvil on his foot. Well, my father, for the rest of his life, had a kind of deformed toe from that experience. But he worked plenty, but he did well in school, so he had an ability, an offer to teach at Notre Dame, and to go to graduate school at Cornell, or to go down to Florida to manage a motel chain. So it was kind of like, wow, he's really at the top of his form. Yeah. But his sister wanted to get married and was hesitant to sort of leave their parents alone. And so she asked my father to come back. And at that time, my grandfather owned kind of a rundown grain elevator in Fairmont, Minnesota. It had very little positive potential. And my father just dropped everything and off he went to take this job that probably no one else would ever take. And he didn't do it with resentment or bitterness, and he turned it into a thriving business.
Yeah, it sounds like he would have had a lot of success whatever he applied himself to, but those bonds and love for family are important. What was your mother's situation, and When did she and your father meet? How did those things come about?
So my mother grew up in Minneapolis, and then she went. She was one of three children. She had two brothers. She went to the College of St. Catherine in St. Paul. And she lived at home because she couldn't afford boarding on the campus. And you have to cross the river from Minneapolis to St. Paul, but she had to take buses. So she had to go in quite a circular route.
Yeah.
So every day she had to get up, to transfer three times to get south, then across the river, then north again. And she spent her 4 years doing that. And I oftentimes speculate as to what, again, that must have been like every single morning, every single night. She never had the kind of social life that normal students, college students could have. And I sometimes wonder, too, all the people she maybe had to sit next to, you know, on a city bus, especially right. The bus passed right by a Ford factory. And so, sure enough, if she was coming home maybe at night after a shift ended, who knows what she had to kind of endure on that bus.
Sure.
She graduated from college, and then she took a course from Brown Institute, which is like a trade school in Minneapolis, training people how to be on the radio broadcasters. She got a job in a little small town in Iowa, and then Fairmont, Minnesota opened a new radio station, and she was the first on-air radio personality in Fairmont, Minnesota, and that's where she met my father.
That's so interesting. Yeah, you wouldn't think of a woman having as many of those opportunities back then, but it sounds like she really took advantage of everything she had there.
Yes, and she oftentimes didn't talk so much about it. When she got married, she decided to concentrate on her family, and she used to say, I don't even like to listen to the radio because I never want to think about being tempted to do anything except for attend to my family. But she must have had quite the time coming into town and being the morning personality on a new radio station. The whole town must have been listening to her.
Yeah, yeah. She was a celebrity in Fairmont there.
Yes.
So it sounds like then your mother made some sacrifices as well for her family. There's that theme that your parents both shared. What led them towards marriage, and what were some of those early years of marriage like for them?
Well, my mother actually had to quit her job at the Fairmont radio station to, again, go home and live with her parents for a little while. By that time, she and my father were just starting to date at that time. And so they carried on a relationship with my father driving up to the Twin Cities, to Minneapolis. And my father was a very, very open person. He embraced everything. Well, he also, of course, was trying to get this struggling business off the ground. Mm-hmm. So one wouldn't characterize him as prosperous at that time.
Mm-hmm.
He would go up, visit my mother. He got in trouble with her parents. My mother lived very close to what was Nicollet Park at the time, and Billy Graham came to Nicollet Park.
Okay.
On a crusade. Well, back in those days, going to if you were a Catholic, going to Billy Graham revival was, well, you could just imagine right. What my mother's father thought about this young man who took his daughter to a Billy Graham revival. And of course, the reason my father took her is because it was free.
Right.
So they had all kinds of experiences. When my father would come up to visit her, he stayed at a hotel. He got to know the night clerk at the hotel, and he'd always try to see if he'd kind of take the last room, the most unwanted room, and negotiate for a room. When we grew up, my father was always taking the kids. Again, they were doing struggling times, and we might go up to Minneapolis, and we'd have 6 to 8 to 10 people in one hotel room. And my father always left us in the car and went in to get the room. And sometimes he would be gone for 45 minutes to an hour.
Yeah.
And I grew up thinking this must be a very complex transaction.
Yeah.
So when I rented my first hotel room, I couldn't help but to think, I must not be doing it right, because I just came in and got the hotel room. And there must be something. Maybe I have to just negotiate absolutely everything. So I never really did know what was going on, but their courtship was unusual, that they got married. They moved to to Fairmont, and they started a family really almost immediately. My older sister was born 11 months after they got married, mm-hmm. and the family, so they had 8 children with a miscarriage along the way. So my mom spent a lot of time building a family, and that became their life. They lived in an upstairs apartment over a department store. My father had one car. He drove it to the elevator 5 miles away, and my mother lived downtown, and they lived there until their first baby, and they had to move to a rented house. My mother never did get a car, never did get a car until she inherited my grandfather's old DeSoto. That's kind of a whole separate story in itself, but they built a big family. My father always said he wanted as big a family as his grandfather, who was an Irish immigrant and who had 9 kids.
Okay.
And homesteaded on a farm, not far outside of Fairmont.
Great. So where do you fall in line there, and what were some important memories and moments that you remember from your childhood?
Well, I would be second oldest. There were 8 children, and so I was the second oldest. I remember living in the house, so I was born in their first house, but kind of was a young boy in their second house that they moved to until it got so crowded again. I think by that time, once my mother and father had their 5th child, they knew that they had to leave this little 3-bedroom house.
Yeah.
We went to a large house. It was empty. It was kind of run down. You know, it's the typical kind of, well, I think about the movie It's a Wonderful Life and the kind of house that George Bailey bought,
you know? Okay.
And we buy this house, right? And you know what? I mean, it's a lifetime of working at this house just to kind of keep it going. And I remember from the very first time we came over to that house, and there was nothing but projects that kept us busy. And my father was pretty good at keeping us busy. But you know, what they did that lasted. The first year we lived in that house, or shortly thereafter, we at that point varnished the woodwork. Well, that varnish is what polyurethane is now. And well, my father wasn't ever going to do it again. So after 6 coats, and varnish is a messy, messy substance.
Yes.
After 6 coats, he tells my mother to have us do one more. And a younger brother was fed up, and he took the varnish brush and just made a big strip right across the wall. Of course, you can't get that stuff off. And I think both my mom and dad said, okay, that's enough. But to this day, Dan, never have we done anything with that woodwork since.
Yeah. done to last, for sure.
Yeah.
And what about faith? You mentioned the importance of Catholic faith already. Where was the role of faith in your family's home?
Well, it was centerpiece. So there was a Catholic church and a Catholic parish there, and there was a Catholic school, went from grades 1 to 8. And I don't know how to kind of describe it more than to say it was a centerpiece. My father was very active in the Knights of Columbus. My mother was very active in the Catholic Daughters, and they were very active together in the Catholic school there. Mm-hmm. So it was at the center of it. Kind of church was, the church was just always there, always a part of it, very, very involved in it. My mother and father started the first endowment fund for a Catholic elementary school in the country. There had never been an endowment fund for a Catholic elementary school, and they did it actually with the help of Notre Dame, because my father would go to Notre Dame and get advice about how to build one, how to start one.
Sure.
And the endowment fund is still in place today, and that school is still operating in this little town, largely because that endowment fund is supporting it now during a time where probably the enrollment and the parish could not have supported it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a gift for future generations, for sure. It's a real blessing. As you were going through your own education, did you have a sense of the unique perspective that your parents had on life that later translated into this book, or just reflecting on their lives? Or were you more kind of blissfully unaware that your family kind of held these principles? Just what was your own perspective on your family growing up?
Well, I think I can say that I wish I'd had a better perspective on it. And I don't think I had a true perspective as we were going through it. Oftentimes, maybe I saw it from a perspective of a kid who had to do different jobs. So after church on Sunday, our family never left church very early. And people would come up to us and they would make it known if they needed something. And it almost became kind of like a service call in a way. Well, we became, and through our mother and father, we became involved in all sorts of different projects. And I guess when you're a kid, I knew my family was different. I knew my parents were very different. Mm-hmm. It was obvious from the things we did, the things we started. They started up when we used to go to Minneapolis to visit sometimes, and my father at a Catholic church. This was back in the 1960s, discovered that some churches were doing a coffee and donuts after church.
Right.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Well, who's going to end up doing a lot of work with that? And so our family for many years hosted coffee and donuts. And my parents took all that in without any kind of complaint, without any kind of burden. And unfortunately, as a kid, I didn't always appreciate that. I didn't see that. And it took for much later in life to see the treasure that my parents were and to see all the different things that they did. Here's a funny story about my parents and their service. Mm-hmm. I think of every Christmas Eve, my father took the family on Meals on Wheels. Do you know that program,
sure,
Dan?
Absolutely.
So he did that, of course, because nobody else wanted to do it on Christmas Eve,
right. Yeah.
So that becomes his project. Now, Christmas Eve gets to be a pretty busy time. In the morning, we would play our instruments for the Salvation Army Christmas lunch. Then we'd rush off to have to do Meals on Wheels. At the same time, I was a procrastinator, I had presents to buy, et cetera. And then we had mass at 4 o'clock. How are you going to fit all this in? So in my short-sightedness, I would get a little impatient with all these projects of my father. One time we went on a Meals on Wheels and we come to the door of this woman and she asks us, well, can we help her wrap her presents? Well, sure, we could do that. Well, as long as we could help her wrap her presents, do you think we could help her mail them? Well, yeah, sure, we could do that. Well, if we could help her mail them, do you think we could actually help her go out and buy them? And so, my poor mom's at home getting them some dinner ready. And basically, this was before the cell phone era.
Sure.
And we just basically have to tell her our entire day has just been changed here.
Starting from scratch here.
Starting from scratch.
That's great. Well, I'm sure that giving spirit made a real impact on a lot of people. Can you talk about the grain elevator business and kind of the evolution of that? That's, I'm sure, a hub of activity and the lessons of agriculture and farmers coming in. What were some of the important principles that your family kind of grew up with the grain elevator?
Sure. So even when my father took it over, so he took it over then in the late 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
And the grain elevator business is a volatile business because grain prices are always going up and down. They can,
sure,
go up and down because of the weather. They can go up and down because of trade relations between nations. So all kinds of things can occur. It's a volatile business and it's a tough business for independents to be in. By the time you get to the 1960s, big corporate chains like Cargill's and Continental's and Bunge's were really kind of domineering. And here's my father with this little grain elevator stuck in the middle of an area which was surrounded by the big companies.
And, mm-hmm,
and we always had to struggle with that. But what's really amazing is that about 3 miles from my father's elevator, a French company put in a huge 100 rail car terminal. Dreyfus, the name of the corporation was. And my father thought Dreyfus was going to drive him out of business. Mm-hmm. I like to think that my father drove Dreyfus out of business because years later they closed. My father was still there.
Wow.
So he really, he did business. I think people patronized him because he treated him with great respect. He gave them little things that I think just made them feel as kind of a part of a sort of family, you know, that we came, we had taught to wait on him. We talked to talk to him. My father had a soda machine, kept the price at 10 cents just because it's old fashioned, but I want people to think that when they come in here, they get a little bit of the old fashioned life. Mm-hmm. And he would hire people. We used to think that when we grew up, we had a skewed idea about employment. We always thought you had to have a lot of problems to get a job, because that's the kind of people I worked for my father. The only way to really get a job is, I guess, to have a lot of problems. And so we got educated in a way as kids from people who had tough times in life. Although I must say that at one point we thought going to jail wasn't really quite so bad, because you got television there with numerous channels, whereas in our house, we only had one television set. It only got one channel.
That's great. That's great. So as you started to go through your education and your career, what was some of that discernment like as you witnessed what your parents had done, some of the decisions they made, and where God was calling you?
Well, I don't know how it kind of came to be, because living with my parents, so many things I think came through or soaked in when you don't really quite realize it.
Sure.
You grow up, I think, oftentimes maybe really not knowing perhaps why you're doing something, you just kind of do it. And I think all my brothers and sisters live lives greatly inspired by my parents, even though when you're growing up, of course, you think, boy, I don't like all these volunteer jobs we end up kind of doing. But you know something, once you kind of get through that early period, it really sunk in, and it kind of anchors in, and it affects your life very much. And my mother and father, the older they got, it seemed like the more committed to their faith they were. In the last years of my father's life, we always said the rosary every night, and that was all very important. I mean, everything surrounding their faith was a centerpiece. And I think when I remember at a time thinking that we always have doubts about our faith, because there's so many reasons to doubt, of course, and there's plenty of opportunity to doubt. And one of the things sometimes I think that helps is if you look at like the wisest people you know, and what do they think? Because why not follow them?
Yeah.
And I used to think it came to a point where I remember thinking the wisest people I know, there's so many wise, but the ones I think of are, I think of St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas and C.S. Lewis and Pope John Paul II. Sure. And then the fifth one in there was my father. So when you have that kind of influence, that really sees you through, and it sees you through some dark times or some doubtful times, and just their example. It doesn't have to be their words. It's their example that sees you through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a real gift that you had. How did you get into teaching and law? What attracted you to that kind of career?
Sure. Well, I guess maybe like many people, I always thought I was going to go to law school, but I didn't really know why I was going to. So, you know, I grew up in a town, and actually one of the friends of my father's graduated from the University of Notre Dame, and he was a lawyer. His name was Tom Doherty. And I got to know him. I visited him in his law office, and I thought, well, maybe I'll be a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And my father used to encourage us to get a profession because he knew how tough business was.
Yeah.
And he also thought it's real tough, not only in with all the challenges of business, but also competing against the bigger guys.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went into law, and it was really by accident kind of that I came to teaching. It was in a way at a time when there was a visiting professor open at the University of South Dakota, and I thought I was at a transition time, and I thought I'll take that. And I liked it so much, I stayed, and I've been very blessed to do that, because it was only 2 hours and 45 minutes away from my parents. And little did I know that later in life, when maybe I could be around more for them, that this gave me the opportunity to do that. And really, and it turns out oftentimes we think that taking care of or tending to parents in their later years can be a burden. And that's true. Mm-hmm. It can be a burden, but in a way it can be some of the best times of your life too.
Yeah, there's I think an appreciation for, well, like you said, you get more of a perspective on what their lives have meant, and there's kind of, you feel that need to glean as much wisdom as you can when all of our time on earth is limited, but you feel that as people start to get older. What were some of those lessons that, as your parents aged and even into their passing, that you were really grateful that you were able to get from them?
Well, I really think when I started writing this book, and I thought, as I thought about it, I wrote it during a time when I actually took a leave on a semester, and I was up on an Indian reservation. Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, I didn't have as much to do. It was a bitter cold winter. And I started thinking about this book, and I started thinking about kind of what was the essence of my parents. And I came to this conclusion that it was really gratitude, that somehow gratitude was the foundation of their life. And I thought that, unfortunately, I wouldn't categorize myself as an inherently, fundamentally grateful person, but my parents were. Hmm. And when I thought about it more, I just thought that gratitude is really what gave them the strength and the inspiration. And it's a gratitude that isn't just we all think of gratitude. Well, if I get a present, I say thank you. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a saying thank you. It's really a deeper attitude where you get up in the day and you start from a perspective of gratitude, and you confront every challenge in your life from a perspective of gratitude. And if you have that, from what I learned from my parents, you can then sort of develop all these other virtues like courage and determination and perseverance through adversity. But even more so, I think, out of faith. And I learned something very important from my mother, that it might be easier to be grateful than to be faithful. Gratitude is based upon really what you experience and see, you know.
Right.
And once you are grateful, though, then you start looking around for, well, to whom should I be grateful?
Sure.
And that is one way that I think can lead you to faith and can lead you to a deeper faith. And it's kind of an interesting route to take. But I think those are the most fundamental lessons that I learned from my parents.
And as you reflect on that, and as you're writing the book, why do you think that is more of a rare perspective that people take nowadays to be grateful or to see God's blessings in their lives? And why do we sometimes more tend to focus on the difficulties or to not recognize God's grace in our daily lives?
Yeah, well, I think of just myself, Dan. I think to myself, I lived a much, much more comfortable life than my parents did, mm-hmm. and I'm probably less grateful. Hmm. So, you know, so why is that? I mean, I guess we can all have our theories about that. My parents seemed to, they approached everything. It seemed like they started and ended from a perspective of gratitude, and they had that gift. Now, maybe that gift was more prevalent in previous generations. I don't know. Maybe there's in our lives just more things telling, more influences telling us all the things we should have and don't have. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's more influences about saying there's some kind of ideal out there that we should strive for. And if we don't have it, then we ought to be a little unsatisfied with it. I don't know, but I've come to see, after thinking about this, really two things. And one is, gratitude isn't just important for us as individuals, but it's pretty important for us as a society and culture, because if you don't have gratitude for your culture or your country or your society, how are you ever going to be able to kind of live together? And instead, I think a divisiveness and even anger has kind of replaced gratitude. And it makes it very difficult for social cohesion or unity if we don't have that sort of sense of gratitude. But on the other hand, Dan, I've also noticed that, and I don't know if I'm just more aware of it, but it seems to me like people are writing about gratitude more. I see in different journals and websites, people writing about, I think that I saw one headline, the need for gratitude now more than ever. I mean, I think we do need gratitude, but one person described cheerfulness and gratitude as an active resistance, kind of how interesting, an active resistance against the kind of culture of dread and gloom that we have, you know, and no question, there's a lot of gloom out there.
Yeah. And sometimes it's the absence of easier times. I mean, obviously we've all been through the pandemic and I don't know, I don't think a lot of us anticipated something going through something like that in our time, but you can gain that perspective sometimes when things that you had before are taken away and then you have that chance again for them to come back. Were there times in your parents' lives where they were able to remain grateful even during hard times? And what lessons can we gain from that?
Oh, yes. Well, I think there were so many times when you're raising eight children, running a business that is highly volatile and uncertain. And if you don't know you're going to make it from one day to the next, I just can't even imagine. I just can't even imagine how you end up doing everything they did, how they could remain so. My mother never got flustered, no matter what. And believe me, she was burdened with a lot of different chores, you know. Mm-hmm. Everybody sort of seemed to know that she would be the person to go to help him out. My father spent his evenings working or helping other people. They came to acquire the kind of reputation where if you really need something, call on them. I remember the time just when the high school band trip took a trip and one of the kids got in trouble and had to be sent home. And so therefore their parents had to pay for him to come home, and who had to go over to deliver the news. But my father, though I remember he came back for his checkbook. So I have my suspicions that there was some assistance given there, but throughout all of that, they never lost their composure. They never got overwhelmed. They never succumbed to despair. And you know how we struggle with despair and despondency and how we pray to God that we don't succumb like that, but they never did. And that's why I think in the book, I talk about the different things about maybe this center of gratitude gave them the strength to keep in mind always the most important thing in their lives, the most important things for which they were grateful, the things that never got taken away from them. Their faith never got taken away from them. Their family never got taken away from them. And it made them endure these times, which were tough. And my father, because of the rheumatic fever, had some really horrible hospitalizations. And gee whiz, during these hospitalizations, what is he doing? He's giving me jobs about who needs a letter, who needs this, I should spend some time visiting some people who need me to have them visit them. And I don't think I could do that, but that was him.
Yeah. So inspiring just to hear these stories. When this finally coalesced into a book, I mean, you've written other books, you know, both in your profession and novels and things. When you were talking with your siblings and other family members, and you kind of had this idea for the book, what were people's reactions to it, and what has been the reception been to it?
Well, I've been surprised at the book. I've written a lot of books, Dan. And when my mother died, I lost my audience. You know what that means, of course. She's sure. The only one reading the book.
That's right. Number one fan.
Yeah, that's right. When I lost my mother, I lost 50% of my audience. So I had never had the kind of reception that I've had for this book. I've never had the kind of reception where people are reading it and they have a lot to say about it and they seem to be impacted by it. It's been very unusual to that extent. I remember when I was writing this book, and I really prayed during that time that I said, I hope this book is fulfilling God's will, that this is that this maybe is giving a message that God would like to give, and maybe I can be the mouthpiece for it. And sure. I tried to I tried to do it differently than any other book. I tried to just say, let me not control things, but hopefully let this sort of flow in the will of God. And it's had a very positive reception, and all kinds of people who have read it seem to have been deeply touched by it. And I've come to the conclusion it's definitely not because of the writing. It's because of the, material and the people about whom I'm writing and the kind of lessons they left to us in life. And so I'm very, very happy about that. And I think very blessed to be a part of that experience.
Yeah. We definitely see that here with our Faith in D Daily Gospel Reflection, this podcast, some of the other seasonal content we do. Sometimes you're just in the thick of doing the work, and then all of a sudden you put that out into the world, and then stories come back to you that you're just floored by really God's grace, I think, working through the humble instruments that we all are. Are there any stories that come to mind of things you've heard from the reactions to the book, or people who didn't maybe even know your parents, where they were really affected by the message, that have been really moments of grace for you?
Yes. But before I do that, Dan, I just also want to say that Daily Gospel Reflection, I love that. I don't know how many people I've sent that to.
Thank you.
And
yeah.
what a tremendous ministry that is. There's just so much there. You always have the gospel at hand. You always have a reflection. You have a prayer. And I really like the biography of the saints. You know, what a great lesson in education. And I don't know how many times it's actually helped me. It even helped me this morning with a very insignificant kind of decision. Mm-hmm. But it just kind of reminded me, don't let your life get so caught up in little distractions that you lose the big picture. So.
Yeah.
I thank you for that.
Oh, well, it's a team effort for sure. But
well,
it's a lot of
you have a tremendous, tremendous impact out there. And it's amazing how the kind of impact you have, you don't always hear about that.
Right.
It's an impact in people's lives and they take it for granted, like we always take it for granted. But you sure are to be commended and thanked for that.
Thank you. It's very kind.
So I set up kind of a Facebook page for this book. Mm-hmm. And I heard from somebody who says, you know, I didn't know your father very well. I waited on him at a restaurant.
Hmm.
And he sent me a letter. And I've always kept the letter and I've always remembered it. And I got a copy of the book and I loved it.
Hmm.
And I thought, wow, how interesting that is. It kind of reminded me, one of the things that led me to this book was actually the experience at my father's funeral.
Right.
And there was a huge crowd that showed up, and as people were going through the reception line, I met a number of people, and if we have time, well, I'll do one. If we have time, I'll do the second.
Sure, please.
One of them was from a young woman in her 20s who told the story of her first communion. They had just moved to Fairmont. They didn't know anybody. At this point, you did your first communion individually. She sat in the front row. Parents were having some troubles, and so she was just with her father. My mother and father went up to him afterwards, and they always gave a little gift to anyone who had anything going on.
Hmm.
And then something prompted them to invite this young girl and her father to breakfast. Her father couldn't make it because, as this woman then told me, he had to have a phone call about with his soon-to-be former spouse.
Mm-hmm.
And so my parents took her out, and that was the beginning of a friendship that, unbeknownst to me, lasted through her high school years. And sometimes when her father would have to go away, she stayed over at the house, and my parents became almost second parents to her. It was all kinds of stories like that. Another story was a younger sister of a woman who was hired at the elevator. This man had severe epilepsy. His parents came to my father and asked if he could just give him they wanted their son to have some semblance of a normal life. And they said, you don't have to pay him. Well, my father paid him.
Sure.
And I remember actually a time when he had a seizure, and it was a very frightening experience because he's on the floor and having this, and the whole elevator was frozen.
Mm-hmm.
My father comes over, takes care of him, inserts something into his mouth so he doesn't swallow his tongue. But what a tremendously impactful moment that was, you know.
Yeah, and sometimes it's those stories that, I don't know what it is about funerals, but all of a sudden people feel compelled to come and tell some of these things. And I remember my own grandmother's funeral and hearing some of the amazing stories. And I think you're both grateful for the chance to know some of those things, but it stings a little bit to have lost such a special person in your life. But again, I think the lasting feeling to your book and a large topic of our discussion today is gratitude. You know, how grateful we are to have interacted with and known such a holy couple of people here with your parents. So let's turn to models of holiness, because we always like to talk about that. I think it's obvious that your parents were some of your own models of holiness, and you've mentioned some others, but for both of them, and then maybe you as well, who were some of the models of holiness that you think really inspired them to be people of such gratitude?
Well, I think they had such close relationships with religious, with priests and nuns. They had we had something like 6 or 7 nuns stationed in Fairmont, you know, teaching. They had very close relationships with them, but they also had they had close relationships. My father always talked about how he prayed to his deceased relatives or actually asked for intercession.
Sure.
And thought that they're always there to help me out. It seems as if for my parents, their deceased family members continued to live alive, to continue to live in their life. They were always sort of alive because they were always going to them and asking for help and guidance. So I think that their families provided great examples of holiness, but not just when they were living, when they continued even on after they had died. And I think they were very confident of where their family members were at the time. Mm-hmm. And they always asked for help there. And I think they got a lot of help. I do remember, I tell this story in the book, I remember when we became teenagers, when we entered our teenage years, and back in my day, teenagers were a kind of a suspect label, you know. Teenagers were, boy, the teenagers were the real troublesome aspects of society, but everybody laughed about it. I got a teenager, oh boy, I got to lock all the cabinets. I got to increase insurance limits on my car. What did my parents do? They bought a statue of St. Anthony, put it in their corner of their bedroom, had a carpenter make 2 kneelers, and they set about praying to St. Anthony. Must have worked pretty well because everybody survived the teenage years.
That's right. That's great. And for you, as you've now prayed to them for their intercession, but also other people in your life who have been impactful to you, who have been some of your models of holiness?
Well, of course, my patron saint is St. Patrick, so I tend to read something, a little writing of his every day. Of course, because St. Anthony seemed to be so faithful and loyal and rewarding to my parents, St. Anthony is another daily someone I go to. I pray. I have a host of saints that I pray to or pray for in their intercessory powers. And I try to, as I go on, to try to appreciate that more and more. I think it's one thing to have faith in God and in Jesus Christ, but how can you get the saints are always held up as a kind of model. So that's been a little bit more, maybe a second kind of step for me to say that, well, yes, I can see trying to have a direct relationship with Jesus Christ, but maybe I ought to have more of a relationship with the saints. Maybe they can kind of help me in ways that I can't help or ways that I can't see. And so I've tried to follow my parents in terms of looking to my deceased family members. I've looked to saints and to try to do that. And of great, great importance to my parents was Blessed Mother. Mm-hmm. And looking there and realizing that the power that she has and how she can provide this certain path that you take. Of course, having gone to Notre Dame, my father was very devoted to the Blessed Mother.
Sure. Well, thank you for sharing that. A couple final questions here. One, just because of the topic of your book and this example of your parents' life, what do you think your parents would say to someone who's listening, who's having a particularly difficult time in life or having a particularly difficult time in finding gratitude in life? What sort of consolation might they offer someone like that?
I think they would probably say that there is gratitude, that there is something very important for you to be grateful about. Don't focus on the things that are causing you pain and worry and suffering. Focus on what it is there that you have, and find that first, and then just kind of hold on to it for everything you have.
Mm.
You're always going to have problems, but hold on to that. So when you're dealing with a difficult challenge, don't forget. I think they probably always say, just keep reminding yourself, here's what I'm grateful for. And what difference does it make over and above that? Certainly as a Christian, one could say, I'm grateful for the gift of salvation.
Sure.
And once you have that, that makes all your troubles look a little minor.
Yeah. Yeah. And in an eternal perspective, somewhat temporary, even though.
That's right.
There can be a lot of suffering in this life, for sure.
But to really take us off track a minute, because I wanted to say something. I wanted to say, what a great insight you had really when at your grandmother's funeral, when you say there's a sting in that too. And I wouldn't have known that until I experience it. But there is a sting. You hear these stories and it makes you grateful. But there's also that little bit of a sting that, on one hand, I didn't fully appreciate it. And then, of course, it makes you realize all the more what you've lost.
Yeah. And thankfully, with our faith, you get that perspective of, by following in these ways of holiness, that we someday have the promise of reuniting eternally with such holy people. So I find even funerals, especially for really holy people, to be a shot in the arm to say, I've got to keep at it. Like, I want to be back with these people. Like, they inspire me to live a holy life as well.
That's right. Like St. Paul's message, keep running the race.
Right. Right. Well, that's a nice segue to our final subject here, which is how to live a holy life. So what were some of your parents' approaches to holiness that have resonated for you and that you would offer as things that you have found to be fruitful in trying to strive after holiness?
Well, I think environment is very important. Put yourself in an environment where that there's going to be reinforcements of messages of holiness. Don't try to do it alone. Find yourself an environment. That's why you need the church. That's why you need groupings of people who are going to help you, who are going to strengthen you. So they probably say that when we think of holiness, we think of a God-centered, and it clearly is God-centered, but don't just think you can do it by yourself. Look to other people and look to the kind of people who are going to help you, and judge your company by whether they're going to make you holier. Don't judge your company just by whether maybe they're a good time or they're popular or something like that. Ask yourself the question, are they going to increase holiness within me? And certainly there's that kind of communal aspect. And of course, prayer is very important, vitally important in all types of prayer. My father and I always took an annual retreat together. And so I think he'd say, maybe the part that they'd say would be that it's not a message we often hear, because sometimes we think of holiness as being a kind of mystical experience that one has one-on-one with Christ. You know what? Look to other people. They'll help you get there. As well as, of course, I think always they said, gratitude will keep you going, even when you might have feelings of doubt, or even when you might have your faith shaken a bit. Always kind of center yourself on gratitude, and you'll realize that everything, all the blessings that have been given to you, And when you think of all the blessings that have been given to you, you've got to have faith, because there you are with what you have. And what better evidence for faith is there than that? All the people healed of miracles in the Bible, what gratitude they had, and that gratitude led immediately to faith. They saw it. And so healing comes to our lives in so many different ways on so many different occasions. And we ought to look at that, just like we read stories of the lame being healed, lepers being healed. That same thing is happening in our lives all the time.
Yeah, and just both wonderful points there. And I think you summarized well the one of the main reasons for this podcast is to hear the everyday stories of people who have lived holy lives. And it's not always mystical experiences on the mountaintop. Sometimes in the humble circumstances, the just everyday commitment that people have, the gratitude they find even during very difficult circumstances, that can, I hope, lead us all. We help each other in finding reasons to give thanks for God's blessings and to be grateful. So just thank you, Patrick, for sharing the story of your parents, Michael and Elizabeth. And thank you for what you've done to share their story with people who didn't have the chance, didn't have the grace and the blessing to have known them, both through this podcast and certainly through the book. I'm sure a lot of people listening to this will be interested in going to read the book, The Power of Gratitude by Patrick Geary. But just want to thank you, Patrick, for your time and for all that you've shared with us today.
Well, thank you, Dan. And like I said before, your ministry is tremendously impactful and pervasive. And I could talk for hours and hours upon the kind of impact you've had, but God bless you.
Thank you. Thank you. God bless you as well. Well, that does conclude this episode of Everyday Holiness, a Faith Indie podcast. As always, we invite you to subscribe to the podcast at any service of your choosing, as well as to our daily gospel reflection at faith.nd.edu/signup. Until next time, you'll be in our prayers, and I am grateful for all of you. God bless.